In my opinion, Richard is the leading expert in the world, academic expert on central banking and banking, and has the best formula of as to how to move forward. And we'll go through his bio in just a second, but let me just
Thank
say
you.
a few words of prayer. Gracious Heavenly Father, thank you for the ability to have this time with Richard Warner to talk about how we can help our people and society move forward in the best and most productive way. We thank you for your support and help and divine intervention. And we know where two or more are gathered in your name, there are you, and through you, anything is possible. So, and we certainly hope that whatever we do in terms of the financial system and banking is in alignment and keeping with your purpose. So in Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Amen.
Okay, so I want to first introduce the Solari team. We have Tim Caban, who is helping me as a co-host on these briefings. He will be leading the briefing for gold and silver for the precious metals model legislation next month, but he's with us today and always has great questions. Our general counsel, Carolyn Betts, is here. Elizabeth Murphy, who leads our STOL state effort. And if you want to arrange a briefing for you and your staff, or you want to be part of one of these briefings, just let Elizabeth know. We're not going to call on her too much tonight because she apparently has just gotten laryngitis. So it was too much talking at the State House this week. And then finally, Ricardo Oscam is managing the slides. And when we get to Q&A, as I said, Ricardo will be repeating all of the questions. He'll be following the questions. If you can add your questions or comments to the chat, you can also just ask to come in and speak if that's what you prefer. Anyway, but so Ricardo will be managing the slides and managing the chat and the questions. So Richard is German by background, studied at in the UK and in Oxford. He is the author of probably, I think, one of the very best books on central banking, The Princes of Vienna. Recommend you strongly. He has tremendous experience both in academia and in the investment community as well. You can see in his resume, it will be on the slides. So next slide. And we have a wealth of information at the Solari Report of interviews with Richard. So great interviews. I don't know anybody better to explain how policymakers can organize state or local finances to really build wealth and build economic development. He's very strong, and we have a series of interviews on that. One of our favorite pieces is he wrote a piece for Tennessee called Why a Sovereign State Bank is Good for Tennessee. Highly pertinent, in fact, to many different jurisdictions. And we are excited. He's just about to publish a new one on why it's good for Florida. And we're looking forward to that. And we will make sure the participants get a link to that when Richard publishes it, and we will have it up on Solari. So today we're going to be talking about organizing a sovereign state bank, why you would want to do it, and sort of into the structuring questions, and then we will have plenty of time for Q&A. So Richard, I'm going to turn this over to you. So take it away, and just let Ricardo know when you want a slide to be changed.
Great. Thank you very much. And thank you for your kind words, Catherine. And it's always a pleasure to work with you and also on this particular project, which I hope and pray will be fruitful. And all of you will help us, and we can all work together in actually realizing this, because it's well, I hope by the end of it, at least you will agree that it's an extremely good proposition with no downside, but so many positives, so many upsides, so much potential. And actually, we are really only going to talk about some key positive aspects, because there's many other positive reverberations if one follows this line of policy of strengthening small local banks and creating a sovereign state bank, which itself is backing and supporting small local banks. Now, we're starting out talking about sovereignty and money creation and liquidity. And as I just said at the very outset, on the topic of money creation and liquidity, particularly if you're talking to other stakeholders and you're introducing them to these concepts, keep in mind, and some people who have not thought about this, they're just taken aback when they hear about the truth of money creation. Take it, on a case-by-case basis. Sometimes you want to bring that argument later at the very end of it, or you can even leave it out because the long list of advantages of having a state bank and having strong, local banks within a state, the list is so long, and they're already extremely convincing, in my view, on their own. And obviously, once you realize about money creation, it's just such a no-brainer. It just has to be done. But it's a bit of a hurdle. I found some people that haven't thought about this, but I think this audience, at least, will be reasonably well acquainted with the importance of the monetary system, the money creation process as such. So I will talk about it, and of course we will hear. Discuss how it's linked to all the other points. There's the benefits of the state bank and the state bank structure, which has some key principles, and of course there's a number of important functions which make it so attractive to have a state level bank. So let's start out with actually just a few charts and some data. The reality that we're currently experiencing, and we've got like there's a few more charts on this, is that in the last 3 to 4 decades, actually some negative trends have happened and continue at the moment if we don't step in, clearly will continue. Namely, the number of banks is declining, has been declining, will continue to decline. There's various reasons for that, but clearly the regulators have played a key role, and we're talking about the central regulators, federal regulators, the Federal Reserve, monetary policy, various bank regulation agencies, FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, among others, clearly have been involved in this. It's a reality. And this has implications, and we're already noticing the results of that. When you split the banks, and America has actually the blessing of having the largest number of banks in the world. Sadly, of course, the number has shrunk a lot, and now it's only a fraction of what it used to be. Still, it remains the largest number of banks. And when you look at the different types of banks, you notice that it's really the small banks and the smallest banks that lend to small firms. Here you see on the right chart the banks that mostly lend virtually all of their lending, commercial lending goes to corporate lending goes to small firms, is of course the small banks. Large banks don't lend to small firms, and there's many reasons for that. The most important one is just the reality of the banking activity. The job at hand involves some time, some resources, some costs, people looking at loan applications, and frankly, when let's say you're a banker and you have a loan application from a small firm, and at the same time, you have a loan application from a very large firm, the amount of time it takes to examine these properly and do your job properly is actually similar. And in many ways, it could be larger. It could be more time and more effort for the small firms for various reasons. So when you have a choice, banks clearly more or less have to, they're in a competitive market, they have to do what makes most commercial sense. This has a corollary. So basically, when this is the reality that large banks lend to large firms and for large deals, we find that small firms only really get good bank funding when you have an economy with many small banks. And that's where we have a problem because the number of banks has gone down, and it's not the big banks that have disappeared, it's the small banks that have been declining in numbers. So there's now fewer small banks, and those that used to be small, they're getting bigger due to mergers. As a result, the lending to small firms has actually gone down. And so what we get is, we live in an age where actually in many countries, the banking systems have been getting more concentrated. There's some common international factors, but they are involved. They do involve the role of central banks and their coordinated policies, which are somewhat similar on certain points across the globe. And so in most countries, we've really experienced this, that the number of banks has declined and the number of small banks has declined. And so the small firms, small and medium-sized enterprises have been finding it harder to get funding. There's clear econometric evidence that as banking systems get more concentrated, which is what's happening in the US and most states on the state level as well, the share of bank lending to small firms goes down. Actually, the only exception, if you go back a little bit in history, has been China. And the main reason is, and I'll come back to China for comparison, it's quite a good comparison. It's because they came from the opposite extreme. Only 4 decades ago, China had the most concentrated banking system in the world. Why? They only had one bank. It used to be a Soviet style central planning system, and you have only one bank. The Soviet Union had Gosbank, China under Mao had the same system, only one bank. But they realized, and that's an interesting story how they realized, but they realized that's actually a problem. And the goal was, under a new leader from 1978, Deng Xiaoping, the goal became to perform and deliver high economic growth. They examined what's necessary, and they correctly found out what we're discussing, namely, the more banks, the better. You need many, many small banks. And so they switched from a concentrated system to one where they had more and more and more banks. Economic growth just went up. And so they became a system where you had more and more small banks lending to more and more small firms. And the number of benefits is extraordinary. Perhaps actually one important point I should make is, okay, I've been talking about small firms. Why are these small firms so important? Because, politicians, for example, will get approached by all sorts of firms, and it's also understandable, just like bankers, particularly when the large firms contact them, then oh, their ears prick up, and oh, what do these very large firms say? And of course, therefore, small firms tend to get overlooked a lot. We mustn't forget that most employment, total employment, the percentage of total employment that's with small firms is the largest. So small firms are very large when it comes to employment. In the US, like in most countries, actually, certainly most of Europe and key Asian economies, the small firms, small and medium-sized enterprises account for between 70 and 80% of employment. And so you have a very direct causal, chain of causation from bank credit, which inevitably will be bank credit from small banks, local banks, to small firms, and the small firms providing employment. And when they get bank credit, small firms actually respond by employing more people. They grow, and they also have a much bigger investment multiplier, giving a certain amount, let's say $300,000 to a small firm, will have an impact on employment and investment. If you give it to a large firm, the same amount, it has no impact on employment. And so that's a very important mechanism that feeds into the macroeconomy. In this chart here, you see that there is a correlation between the number of banks, and small firm success. Now, we don't have time to go into detail. If you're interested, I'd be happy to talk more about this. There's this concept called hidden champions, which is small firms using the international definition of SME, small medium-sized enterprises by size, so these small and medium-sized firms that at the same time, despite being small, are actually globally leading in their market niche. Champion because the idea is we look at the top positions, gold, silver, bronze, number one, two, or three, top market share in the world held by this small firm. If that's, if you succeed in that, then you are a hidden champion. A champion because, like the Olympics, gold, silver, bronze. Why hidden? Because it's a small firm. These firms are not really known. They're not household names in their market niche. If you're very specialized in that niche, you will know them, but otherwise they're usually not known. That's why they're called hidden champions. And when you look at the world, it's clear that some countries have a very large number of hidden champions. Germany actually has the largest. And then runners up are countries with similar features, namely Switzerland. Austria actually is not in this chart, but it's right there between Germany and Switzerland. Luxembourg, perhaps another similar one, where you have just a very large number of hidden champions in absolute terms or per capita. And the reason for that is that in these places, the banking sector is very decentralized. There's many small local banks that specialize in lending to small firms, and you can't be a hidden champion if you don't get funding. So there's a direct link here. The reality is, as I mentioned, the number of banks has been declining. It's also true in Europe, across the globe, and it's also true in the US. First, the total number of banks has, in a way, fallen off a cliff from the 80s, mid 80s onwards. But what's also happening now is that the number of branches, total number of branches, is declining, coming off, of course, very much larger numbers. And in some other countries, this is even more dramatic. Next slide, please. By the way, actually, we should mention, well, some of the factors behind this. So we had, I mentioned already, central bank monetary policy, interest rate policy, but also regulatory policy, which has been very much favoring large banks and placing such a big regulatory cost and burden on small banks that often they see no other way out than to merge. But there's even more dramatic government intervention, because the previous data was from the FDIC, reminded me. There's a study by Federal Reserve Bank economist Ashcraft. You can read up in the American Economic Review, Top Economics Journal, 2005. And this Federal Reserve economist asked this question that only an economist can come up with, namely, what happens when you close down local healthy banks? Will this have a negative impact on the economy or a neutral impact? And only an economist can even ask that question because you see, economic theory, the mainstream theory that's being used by central banks, says it doesn't matter. The number of banks is not important. Banks are usually not included in their economic models. They use DSGE models without banks. And if there are fewer banks, it doesn't matter. There's no difference. And anyway, there's many alternative to banks. There's non-banks and various other financial market, direct capital market funding, and that. So the theory says banks don't matter, and small firms, you close them down, it shouldn't matter at all. Okay, so he asked that question, and he did this empirical study. But hang on, where did he get data from? Do we have data on empirical, actual data on what happens when you close down healthy banks? Who on earth would close down healthy banks? Well, sadly, there is a big data set from the FDIC because it's been in the business of closing down healthy banks. That's a fact. Read it up. And so he got that data. The argument is that, well, if a bank's in trouble, that creates various, causal chains of causations. We're not interested in that in this case. We want a healthy bank, so you can't have a, we're sort of controlling for the health of the bank. But it's astonishing that there is such data, because the reality is that bank regulators have been far too eager to close down the number of banks. So as a result, bank concentration has clearly increased, and there's a number of measures for that. This is now just indicators of bank concentration, where you see that top five, top 10, or whichever top group of banks you throw together, their percentage share of the banking market has been increasing. Next slide, please. Which is essentially by definition true when you have the number of banks going down, and therefore it's not surprising to find what we see here in this chart, that the community banks, the small local banks' share of the loan market has also been declining. And of course, when you look at absolute loan numbers, the green line, you see the business cycle, and 2008 initially there was a bit of a rise, but then since then actually a secular decline as bank mergers have increased, and the bigger banks and alternatives, and also the whole fintech business, which again was created by regulators entirely top down, started in Europe. If we had time, we could talk about that. Has meant that small banks have found it harder to maintain their market share. Next slide, please. And so what happens when the number of banks goes down is small firms are being squeezed out, because they're the only ones that are really championing small firms. The reality is, well, in economic theory, the theory says, oh, it doesn't matter. You can get money from anywhere. Go to the financial markets, go to any investor. The reality is that small firms, and it's actually well documented, are essentially dependent mainly on bank funding for external funding, and it's only the small banks that will lend to them. Capital markets are not interested in them because they're too small. You have very high minimum costs. In investment banking, the minimum fee for any deal is a certain amount. It's not a very small number, and if you have a small firm, well, it's just impossible. You can never generate the minimum fee that you need to get all the lawyers and investment bankers going and get them out of bed in the morning. So it's not going to happen. So and that's well documented. So what we see here is, as the number of banks goes down, small firms get squeezed out of the economy, and that's also true, and this is very painful, in terms of employment. They are the biggest employer, and they're being squeezed out, that creates a very different labor market. And this is, of course, what we've been seeing in recent decades. When you analyze the labor market data and you realize, oh wow, okay, let's say there's some good labor numbers, and it turns out, oh, these are all sort of McDonald's burger flipping jobs. It's really in the small firms where you had a volume of more skilled jobs, and that's really being squeezed out. The good jobs are being squeezed out. Well, one of the pieces of evidence that this downward trend in the number of banks is a regulatory decision, is this chart here, where we find clear evidence that the number of new licenses for newly established banks has completely collapsed, particularly since 2008, when the bank regulators in most countries in the Western world adopted very pro big bank and anti small bank rules. Despite the fact that this 2008 crisis, which is usually used as the justification, was caused by big banks and central banks, so the biggest players. So in many ways, this is the trouble in the current setup that we have. The central planners and their favorites, which are the very big boys, big banks, it doesn't matter what happens. Even when there's a crisis, that crisis will be used to further their goals, to further concentrate the system, even though every analyst would agree that, oh, it was the big banks, and yes, we need to therefore make sure that banks aren't too big to fail. So how come all the regulatory innovation after that resulted in more too big to fail banks and fewer small banks? It's mind-blowing. And when you have a banking system consisting of a larger number of small banks, it's actually much more resilient to crises. And that's another important point. Of course, it connects to when we talk about the small banks in a state, and then how to make sure they're strong when there's pressure, when there's crisis, whether designed or by chance. And it's clear that a system consisting of many small banks is much more resilient to any shock. And sadly, we have to prepare for some big shocks ahead, which is why all this is actually quite urgent. But yes, I think this is a very damning chart. Now, I've myself spent actually years trying to get a banking license in the UK, and we came up against what was essentially unwillingness to award a license and all sorts of games being played, the goalposts being changed all the time, the hurdles being raised. Whenever we met the next challenge, they created new challenges. Unbelievable. So they're not keen to increase the number of banks is a fact. So the ones that we have, we need to cherish, and we do need to work on this, and we need to confront this problem. And I think, as part of the policy initiatives that we're working on, we should be able to, by making this public and debating this, we should actually even turn around that policy and make sure that it becomes something the public demands. We want small banks. We want more banks. And by the way, my research on the U.S. banking sector also showed, and there's more charts on this. This is just a few charts included here, but I did a time series study with one of my doctoral students, and we found that, this the usual result, which hadn't been properly established, that the number of that it's the small banks lending to small firms and the large banks don't lend to small firms, they lend to large banks, fine. But also we found that over time, this is longitudinal study, 25 years, as these small banks and the smallest banks get larger, even they will reduce their lending to the smallest firms. So it's almost an unavoidable process. It's just the reality of a profit-oriented business. You have to be efficient. So they always try to lend to the biggest type of customers because that makes sense. So as the small banks over time naturally get larger, just with economic growth, nominal growth, monetary expansion, inflation, all the nominal variables being scaled up, this is what happens. We need to. From this we learn we need to always create new small banks because the existing ones anyway will get bigger and they will stop lending to the smallest small firms. So the solution is to always create new banks. That used to be the policy, it seems. We used to have hundreds of new bank creations in the US per annum. But sadly, that's history. And so we have to change it. I think you already get the point about the economics. When you have many small banks, economic performance will be much better. There will be more employment, more stable employment of the right type, skilled employment, long-term employment. When banks create credit, small firms are the borrowers because it's a decentralized banking system with many small banks. You get also more non-inflationary economic growth. You get high growth without inflation, without banking crises, which is the ideal scenario that everyone wants. And the way to get this is to make sure we have many small banks and we also create new small banks and make sure they stay strong. And for that, that's one important, very important reason why it makes sense to have a state bank. And on the picture, in the picture here, you see the Bank of North Dakota headquarters in the state of North Dakota. And well, it has the this unique position that it's currently the state in the United States that has a state-owned bank. that fulfills this very important function. The Bank of North Dakota is owned and controlled by the state of North Dakota, and its role is not really to act directly as a retail banker. I mean, they have all the facilities, they could do it, and that's important to have all the licenses and facilities, but really it's mainly acting as, well, the banker to the state. That's a very important function, and has many benefits for the state, particularly when there's more concentration and there's various federal policies being implemented that are not really good for the state. It's important to have your own state bank, but in reality, the main function in practice on a day-to-day basis has been to be the backup, and in some ways, the central bank of all the state chartered, state level local banks. And that's why North Dakota has one of the strongest community bank, small bank, local bank sectors, where the small banks have done better compared to other states because there's always been a backup. And the Bank of North Dakota has always taken that as one of their core missions, and that's worked very well. Banking is a network industry because some people say, well, hang on, isn't that competition? Wouldn't a state bank compete with banks? That's a complete misunderstanding. If you've been in banking, you know that banking is a network industry, and networks thrive when there's more players, there's more members of the network. And obviously, the organization of the network is also important. And here, the WISE organizational principle, the structure was chosen that you have a state level bank with a public mission for the benefit of the people of the state. And that includes making sure there will be a thriving local bank, community bank sector. And that way, you have obviously the market forces and the markets, playing out. And we're not talking about central banking or any socialist ideas, quite the opposite. In fact, if you go back to China, that was the radical break that Deng Xiaoping introduced. Before, it was a communist central planning system. And he was a radical, and he was clever about it. He said the first point he made is that, oh, let's forget about this ideology. We've had too much ideology. And of course, he was saying this communism, is not working. Okay. He had to be diplomatic about this. And so let's do what delivers performance, which is a radical break. You actually, that's the scientific methodology where you do what works and what is empirically being proven to work. He went to Japan with all his experts, and the Japanese told him how they got 15% growth for decades. That's what Deng Xiaoping wanted, and he wanted to do that in China. And the Japanese told him, well, how many banks do you have? One. Well, you need as many banks as possible, thousands of banks for China. And that's what he did. He came back from Japan and he created thousands of local banks, community banks, village banks, savings banks, credit unions, provincial agricultural banks, all sorts. Almost the same amount of banks as in the US now, close to 5,000. And China then delivered 40 years of double-digit economic growth based on these small banks. And of course, one mechanism I haven't mentioned, and I commented earlier that one doesn't need to add this in the argument, but if you're interested and you understand this, then if you've thought a bit about the money creation process, then it's a no-brainer. Where does the money supply come from? Most people think it's the central bank or the government. Well, governments don't create money anymore. The last US president who did that was JFK in 1963. And yeah, it didn't work out too well for him. And no other president has dared to do this. The Federal Reserve only creates 3 or 4% of the money supply. 97% roughly of the money supply normally is created by the banks. The banks are actually money creators. They're not financial intermediaries, as the fake economics theories proclaim. which is really just a, you know, it's a distraction to cover up what's really happening. These economic theories, empirical reality, empirically proven in my published peer-reviewed journal articles, is that when a bank gives a loan, the money for the loan is not coming from deposits or from, you know, existing resources. It's not transferred from somewhere else inside the bank or from outside the bank. Effectively, banks have a license to create money, and when a bank gives a loan, the money is newly created and added to the money supply. And that's important because to realize this is important because when you create money, it's obvious to everyone that this will have an impact. If you're just shifting resources from A to B, this could also have an impact, but it will be small because it's just, you know, yes, you have more here now, but you have less there, plus minus zero. But when banks lend, it's not just a transfer, it's actually a causal factor of many things. There will be a lot of economic responses to money creation. The most obvious being that if it's money creation, bank credit for consumption, you get inflation, consumer price inflation. If it's bank credit for asset purchase, you get asset inflation. If it's bank credit for productive business investment, that's what we want, then you get growth without inflation. And that's what Japan did, Korea, Taiwan, and then Deng Xiaoping wanted it for mainland China, and they implemented it. And when you have many small banks, then essentially, small banks have a higher percentage of their lending that goes to small firms for productive business investment. So you get high growth without inflation, without crises. And of course, that's what we want. You know, in another presentation that Catherine actually encouraged me to give a few years back, I talked about abundance, because economists love to talk about scarcity. And they say, oh, economics is about scarcity. And well, the reality is we can have abundance and prosperity for all. It's actually a lie to say that, oh, it's all about austerity and you know, scarcity. It's not true. And well, if we had time, we could talk more about this. There's plenty of empirical evidence, but let me just say that we can, and China has demonstrated in a very short time period, lifting more people out of poverty than anywhere in history. You know, in these 40 years of double-digit growth, we can have high growth, high economic performance, and prosperity for everyone. But you have to have the right banking system. And to suppress this, we had all this fake economics to suppress the knowledge and then the policy conclusions. Anyway, so it's clear that if you have a sovereign state bank that has these double functions, one is to be the banker for the state, and that's quite interesting what you can do there. There's a number of things. Important functions. But the second function is to be the banker of all the local banks in the state on the state level. Then you are essentially creating the institutional framework for prosperity and abundance. And also, you're making it much more resilient from the attacks that we know and historically, you know, have happened time and again from central banking policies. The central planners have a track record of creating crises, banking crises for their purposes. And sadly, the fact is a central bank has a lot of power over banks, and they usually succeed in creating crises and then using that to concentrate the banking system and reduce the number of banks. And one of the few ways we can hold against that, short of abolishing the Fed, let's say, which, you know, is something we should also consider. But anyway, short of changing the current federal system, is, and something we can actually do, is to establish a state bank that backs and sponsors local banks and works with them. And of course, the ownership should be on the state level, and the governance should be, you know, a part of the governance of the state, democratic local accountability, including auditing. The Fed hasn't been audited. Hopefully, perhaps, exciting, you know, news. We may get an audit of the Fed for the first time ever. But, you know, don't hold your breath. I think Catherine has looked into trying to audit money flows in various government agencies. And, well, what we see now says a lot, and confirms, of course, what Catherine had been finding already years ago. that all sorts of shenanigans happen. But not, basically, it's a principle in a human organization. When organizations get too large, they become unaccountable. And also, they become corrupted. And, just using this word in a sort of general, very general sense. So it doesn't have to be mean and really the worst type of corruption, but it's sort of just systemically corrupted, as in distorted from the original aims. It's almost inevitable when you have too much concentration of power and there's no more ability to have proper transparency and proper checks, because there's so much concentration that it's the organization is too big. And then even when there's some willingness to check and also to have some accountability, it's just not happening because it's the structure has become too unwieldy. You know this also from the inside already, from a British political thinker, Lord Acton. Centuries ago, he put this very succinctly. He said, "Power corrupts," and with this he meant, when you're in a position of power and decision making, you have a lot of temptations. Most people can't handle that, and they will succumb to these temptations. That's what we call corruption. So power corrupts. And then he said, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. And he was, surprise, surprise, very much aware of the banking concentration. And it was clearly one of the things he had in mind when he said that. So by having a more decentralized system, we can actually introduce proper, ongoing, regular accountability, because on the local level, this is more possible. And so the more decentralized, the better. Just briefly, there's other functions that a state bank can perform. A bullion depository function, which has many advantages. And one theme actually behind all of these things in the bullion role, is just, is another concrete step to achieve some of these goals, is to create a sound system that is resilient to shocks and to attempts to undermine it by centralized powers, whether it be the central bank or some global, financial event that may happen. And so by having a link to gold, and also having sort of a bullion reserve, and also a deposit taking system, you can go back to the roots of banking. That's how banking started out. People deposited gold, they got deposit receipts. The deposit receipts started to be used as money, and you can sort of reintroduce this. It allows every state to have what de facto would be an alternative currency without calling it that. You don't have to give it a different name. You can use dollars still. So it's not so obvious, which may be helpful to the powers that be. They don't necessarily see that really you are establishing what de facto is a local currency. And in many ways, this is actually is another important point, particularly when we talk about the pending initiative to have central bank digital currency. The name CBDC, central bank digital currency, is a misnomer on purpose to mislead people. The idea, or the suggestion here, is that the new thing is the digital thing. Central banks also need to offer this digital stuff. We have cryptocurrencies, we have Bitcoin. Central banks need to join the game, right? And we need something properly organized and regulated and supervised by the central bank. So central bank digital currency is needed. Well, the reality is we've had BDC, bank digital currency, for many decades. Well, essentially, as soon as digital systems were introduced, banks were the first to utilize them. So the first digital money was actually bank digital money. And it works well. We currently have it. Everyone is using it on a daily basis in various forms. Bank digital currency is nothing new. So what is new? The centralization aspect, the C in CBDC. that the central banks now want to get in onto the turf of the banks. And of course, the result is likely to be further concentration of the banking system, driving banks out of business, even the threat that all banks will disappear and only the central bank will survive, because the CBDCs empower central banks to shut down everyone else, including the federal government and the ability of politicians to decide about fiscal policy and budgets, because if you have programmable CBDC, that is de facto your political and economic government from the moment this sort of system starts operating. So now I've mentioned that because as we look at what a state bank can do, by having the ability to operate alternative systems and maintain the strength of your local economy and maintain your local bank-based, small bank-based monetary system, you already have your local currency. And then you can, there's a whole string of policies, depending on how the central planners go about pushing CBDC, you can then respond quite flexibly with measures that will maintain sovereignty on the state level. And in fact, actually on this course, on this content page, the topic of sovereignty is mentioned first. I've slightly changed the order. So let me just say a few words on the sovereignty issue. Sovereignty is the ability to decide important things yourself or for your community. And of course, here we're talking about the state level. So for states to make important decisions that affect livelihoods and the future of the people in that state. Money is a very powerful tool, and it has been used historically and continues to be used to undermine local sovereignty and state-level sovereignty. And a sovereign state bank is a very powerful response to that, to enable states and give them the institutional framework within the current setup. You're not having to create a new financial system. No, you're just creating a suitable institution, which we, already witnessed in North Dakota successfully for a century, that enables the sovereignty that that people want for the state level to continue to exist in the future and to strengthen it. Yes, what states can do, 10th Amendment, if something is not prohibited, the state, of course, has the right to do it. Powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited, is reserved to the states. Is there more? Do we have
So,
more?
Richard, what I wanted
Yes.
to mention on that
Excellent.
slide was we've published a complete collection of all the things a state can do, with the sovereign state bank being the lead recommendation, but many other things the states can do to protect financial freedom, and in combination with the sovereign state bank would be useful. And that's available in PDF at that link. And we also have hard copies,
Excellent.
which we will send to any government legislator or staff or executive branch officials. So that is available. And I wanted to remind them with the next slide that that this would be available in edited form. And you can see, so you can see where you, if you go to where you can register, you can get it as soon as it's available. But we have posted, and you can get the link in the chat, the slides from this presentation, and we will post a audited version of this at the, and you can access it from that link. So those were the slides we had for your presentation, Richard, but it's some states constitutionally cannot
Yes.
start and own a sovereign state bank, but it would be possible for them to start a bank that was owned privately, that just focused on serving the state in this way. And so it's
Exactly.
possible the local banking community could come together and do the equivalent of a New York Fed for a state if there's a constitutional block, which would not be as attractive as the state owning it, but if that's constitutionally not possible. So that's one of the things Tennessee has looked at. Okay, so Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Richard, for this wonderful presentation. My question
Thank
is,
you.
I have a couple of questions and I'll let other people ask and come back. But my first question is with regard to sovereignty. And so, for example, if a, and I know you mentioned this a little bit, but maybe you could explain here. So if a bank is a private, a local bank or a bank in a community is creating money by lending it, by creating loans. The dollars are like, for example, I'm holding a $20 bill in front of my hand that says Federal Reserve note. Or another example, if I go to my bank, my local bank, and ask for, say, 30 $100 bills, they might not have it that day. And then they have to order it, my understanding is from the Fed. So what does that say about sovereignty if you are lending in a currency that you don't control?
Right. Thank you for this excellent question, which actually raises a point that a lot of people are wondering, or versions of that people are wondering about. In response, let me first point out that in the old days, when there was no Federal Reserve, and in Europe, it used to be true for all the countries, actually globally, it used to be true before the rise of the central banks. Let's put it this way. All the banks would issue paper money. And in the US, of course, that was so widespread that a lot of people still remember, or they've seen the old notes issued by various banks. And now, of course, maybe they have no more value, but there's a lot going around because there were many banks. At one stage, it was completely unregulated. You just set up a bank just like that. I mean, these were the good old days. And and that's because when a bank gives a loan, it creates money. It was more obvious in those days because literally the bank would simply print the notes with its bank name on it, and you're the borrower. Here's the money. You're borrowing it. Here it is. It's our paper money that we're lending to you at interest. And now, at law, legally, each of those pieces of paper money are promissory notes. They're securities, IOUs of a particular type. I mean, it follows in the in actually in the English tradition, English law. There are And in England, it remains the unchanged system. So that it goes back to the Bill of Exchange Act of 18, what is it, 1884. And the paper money issued by central banks is also just a promissory note, because the central bank is also a bank, and it does the same as banks used to do, except that now it's there's a new regulation which says the banks are not allowed to do it anymore, only the central banks do it. But it's still the same thing. So when a central bank issues paper money, Federal Reserve notes, they are promissory notes, which is a type of bill of exchange, which is a credit instrument, a security of the type called promissory note, of the type called bearer promissory note, because whoever is in possession is the owner, and you don't need to prove ownership because you're holding it. Then the only sort of privileged position is that in many countries, legal tender laws were introduced, which gave a special legal status then to these particularly central bank issued bank notes. But that's why we call them bank notes, because it's what all banks used to do. If you go to Scotland or Northern Ireland, where the revised English legislation never applied, Bank of England notes are not privileged there at all. They're not, they don't have a monopoly. And the normal commercial banks, privately owned banks in Scotland and Northern Ireland, still issue banknotes. So there you can see the history basically live while it's happening. Now that's the background. And so with this in mind, when you say, okay, I go to the bank and I want money, well, you've been told you should ask for Federal Reserve notes, but it's a convention. Even if if they're legal tender, it's actually not clear that anyone can force you to accept them. If people decide we don't want to use Federal Reserve notes, and then even their legal tender, it's hard to implement it. And if there's legislation that prevents banks from issuing such bearer promissory notes, then of course they can't. Then one has to maybe look into this if one wanted the local banks to or a state bank to issue such promissory notes. It may not be impossible to change the relevant legislation to allow it. Because the fact is, central bank money is just that. It is Federal Reserve promissory note, a credit note, a credit instrument. But of course, in many ways, nowadays we don't need it anymore because we're using, and this is what happened with the Bank of England Act of another year in the 1800s, 1800 and I don't know, also 1880s maybe, where the Bank of England outlawed the banks, the private banks in England and Wales from issuing their own bank notes. It should all be Bank of England notes, with the exception of Scotland, Northern Ireland. And so some people thought, oh, the banks are not creating money anymore. Of course they are. They still are, but it just doesn't take the form of a bearer promissory note of a piece of paper. It takes the form of your bank deposit account from which you can write checks, which is very similar. And in many ways, you don't need a state bank to issue its own paper money because there's alternative instruments that fulfill the same function. Okay, so keep that also in mind. But now I come to a very straightforward response to your question. Let's say you do want Federal Reserve notes and nothing else, and you won't be happy with any alternatives, local bank, entry into their, money credit in the account of a local bank or the state bank, if you're not happy with that, although that may be sufficient for most people, then yes, the banks will have to go to the Federal Reserve and obtain those Federal Reserve notes, and then it just becomes a question of logistics, how long it takes to get them, trucked over, and so on. But keep in mind, except for this somewhat, slightly dubious legal tender status, Federal Reserve notes are just promissory notes. We are issuing promissory notes when we take a loan. The loan itself is a promissory note. It's just not a bearer promissory note. So it will have names of the borrower and the lender on it, which has the advantage that, if you lose it, nobody can actually do anything with your mortgage contract, So it actually makes it safer for being not a bearer instrument. But otherwise, it is a credit note. And of course, banks can issue their credit and state banks can issue credit. So in many ways, the workarounds. Now, with a gold depository function, we are introducing another angle here and the ability to issue deposit receipts. This is also actually the line of thinking that JFK followed when he created treasury money, dollar bills, promissory notes issued only by the treasury, not Federal Reserve on it, because they were silver deposit receipts. And so, there's a long history and it's, they still exist. It's just not newly issued, but they, certainly a state bank could issue confirmation, perhaps not in paper, but in digital form or in record, in you know, physical record entry form of credit, and therefore also enable credit creation. That's the history of how this money creation actually came about, is deposit receipts. And then when you borrow, essentially fictitious deposit receipts are issued because it's, you know, it's just a record of the what the bank owes to the borrower, and all deposits are records of what the bank owes. And then when a bank gives out a loan, it creates new debt on itself, and that's why banks can create money. So yes, you know, it's a limitation if you insist on these Federal Reserve notes, and there may be delays until the bank gets enough. Of course, there is the lender of last resort function that the central banks are supposed to provide, you know, almost any amount if in demand. That's at least the rationale they justify setting up the Federal Reserve. On the other hand, if people insist on the federal notes, you give a lot of power to the Federal Reserve. They can use that to create liquidity crises for banks. I mean, why did Silicon Valley Bank receive no liquidity line from the Fed until it was bust? Then suddenly, after the FDIC took over, then they had the liquidity line from the Fed. So it's in the hands of the Fed. If you know, insist on a Fed tool, of course you give more power to the Fed. Does that answer your question?
It does, Richard. And I just my thought as you gave me this tremendous answer is that we need an elevator speech because to communicate this concept requires marketing and convincing people. So to take you what you just said and put it in an elevator speech or in today's parlance, maybe a meme to be posted, that would be helpful, I would think, to people that work in legislatures. That have to communicate to people that aren't already true believers, for lack of a better word.
So, Richard, we have a question in the chat. Ricardo, you want to ask the question about the Fed that's in the chat?
I will, Catherine. There were a couple questions in regards to the state bank and its role within the Federal Reserve System or central bank system worldwide, for that matter, just any central bank system, and how to retain sovereignty within that system if it continues to operate within that. Catherine has answered part of that, and you, Richard, in your explanation just now, you've already touched on that and building alternative systems, for example, using gold or the JFK system. Those kind of systems you've already talked to as well. Now, for the benefit of the audio recording, why don't I just read Catherine's elaboration here first and then jump to that final question, Catherine, which is about the abolishing, correct?
Right,
Okay,
right.
so let me skip.
But sorry, you want to ask about how the is the bank immune to the central bank? And I think it's important to understand the role of the Fed wire and the dependency on clearance and the importance of having independent systems.
So that I want to read out loud right now, Catherine,
Okay.
what you typed up. So you answered this question saying if it uses, it being the state bank, if it uses the Fed wire, it will still be subject to Fed control. If it creates independent systems within the state, it can protect the state and the state citizens and businesses from outside influence within the state, including from the Fed. Another reason essential not to give up cash and checks.
Very well put. Absolutely. Exactly. Very
We
succinct, Catherine.
then also have a follow-up question on that matter where this lady asks, if what if independent systems within the state are mixed up with, for example, CBDCs? That needs unpacking. So that's a bit of a follow-up to that. And then maybe as a third, giving you the ability to answer all of them at once, Richard, as you so eloquently do. The final one to add to the mix is, if we abolish the Federal Reserve and the IRS, will we still be using Federal Reserve notes?
Well, that one is the easiest to respond. If we abolish the Fed, then of course there are no more Federal Reserve notes because they are issued by the Fed and they are Federal Reserve credit. And again, linking to the earlier things I said, the bank money creation is bank credit. That's why the technical term is actually credit creation, and that's where the money supply comes from bank credit creation. And it's created by banks, but this is not actually legally privileged. It's simply private company credit. It's only in reality privileged because the banks have a license to take deposits, and therefore they have the ability through the banking network, and that's why, a strong state level network is important and creates a lot of potential for prosperity. Within this network, you can then use the advantages of this credit creation, and because it's fungible, any company can issue a credit note and say, I give you credit, or I pay this on credit, I owe you, here's an IOU. Normally, this IOU is not fungible and it's hard to get others to accept it. And that's what the banking system does. It's a way of making this credit created like any credit, company credit that can be created without limit. But it follows certain rules and principles that includes, risk management and controls, and local accountability for the local banks. And the money then becomes fungible, transferable, and you get all these externalities, positive externalities, scale effects, and benefits for everyone. And that's, of course, the problem with any alternative system. We see it with the cryptocurrencies. There's a lot of coin launches and initial coin offerings and various cryptocurrencies. They're only as good as they're popular and are accepted by many people, which in reality is still extremely limited. Particularly since they're not really used for actually for transactions. It's more like an asset. Suddenly people love oil paintings. You get lots of stories about oil painting prices rising, and all the auctions are being highlighted in the media. There's phases like that. That's essentially also what all the coin offerings are at the moment. It's a particular asset market. It's not yet, or it's not properly a sort of alternative financial system, but it has the potential to be used for that. But do we need it? We have a much better system, which is already digital currency, namely bank digital currency in the banking system. And then we have the ability to shape that, make it always, make ensure that we're always locally accountable and also resilient on the state level. So there's many more possibilities for people on the state level and also for state level government to ensure the benefits of the monetary system accrue to the people. And that's why, doing it through a banking system on the state level, to me clearly is the best solution. But you don't hear these innovators talk about that, because actually the agenda behind that, all the fintech and the cryptocurrencies and central bank digital currency, is the opposite. They want to get rid of local banking, state level banking, and certainly they don't want states to set up sovereign state banks. Quite the opposite, they want to reduce the number of banks. Banks have been really the target of this central planning operation. I think they sort of switched into high gear from 2008 onwards. Although, of course, when you look at the history, it's a much older agenda, but it's really moved into high gear since then. That's also why we just need to do the opposite. It's quite clear. If they don't want us to do this, that's exactly therefore what we need to do.
I thank you,
So
Richard. This question is with regard to taxation. So currently, gold or silver in the US at the federal level is a capital asset. So it's taxed not like currency, but like stocks and bonds. And it's the same situation as currently exists for cryptocurrency, which is also taxed as a capital asset. And that presents problems when you try to use it as currency. But my question, just it's really to think about, as you say, creating the best solutions and how to confront these challenges. Even if a state changes gold or silver to currency, and the but the IRS or the federal government does not, then that could create a challenge that needs to be confronted because of different tax results that could be widely different, and the federal government could use against states who want to use metals as currency.
So, Richard, I
Yes.
just wanted to mention some of the states, when they've made gold legal tender, have also proposed, if that doesn't work for purposes of relieving precious metals from the federal tax, that they will offer a credit on the state tax.
Okay, that's one way around it. There may be some other workarounds as well. For instance, often when a public coin is minted, and one would have to check whether a state has the right to do it. But if it's not prohibited, then they by default have the right. And then it becomes a currency, and then it is treated differently. So, for example, when gold is in the form of a coin that has the status of currency, the tax treatment will be very different. So, there's all sorts of workarounds. And they will depend on the precise situation in that state, but that may be another one. I mean, I'm all for minting new gold coins on a state level. I mean, that sounds great to me, and it's quite exciting, all the different beautiful gold coins you can imagine for each state. And we'd have to look into how to make this happen, that they can have the status of currency, which, by the way, doesn't mean that the value, the actual market value, will be somehow dictated. No, it's just it's a tax classification by calling it currency, but the value is still dependent on the gold price, basically.
Any more questions? Is there any more in the chat, Ricardo?
Okay, this is a lengthy one. I'm going to read it out loud. If I understand the meaning of fungible money is mentioned, is that akin to fiat money and thus fractionated into nothingness? So even gold-backed crypto or dollars being fungible, it does not seem there is a way to have a way to a base value due to the unlimited fractionation. If this is correct, then how is any creating of credit, which would seem to be a fungible money, a viable solution to sovereignty?
Okay, there's a few concepts in here, so let's try to separate them out. First of all, the fractionation concept here, I believe this does come back to the so-called fractional reserve system, which is a textbook description of the bank money creation process that still some textbooks that do mention banks' ability to create money. They will then rely on the fractional reserve explanation. But I've shown in my work that the so-called fractional reserve theory is actually just plain wrong. It was created as the first initial attempt starting in the 1960s. Actually, well, it became dominant from the actually older. It started really in 1920s until the sort of the end of the 60s, okay? The fractional reserve theory is quite common. So a lot of people still know this, or some textbooks still mention it. But that was actually just an attempt to confuse matters and cover up the reality that each individual bank can create money. Because in the fractional reserve theory, each bank is just a financial intermediary. It doesn't create money, but as the banks interact, there is money creation. So you see, it was step one in the central planner's agenda to cover up the actual reality of banks being able to create money. Each bank individual can create money. So I empirically showed this and disproved this fractional reserve theory. And so I would recommend just not to use that concept, even in a, in this way of talking about fractionization and fractional, because it does go back to this original fractional reserve concept, which is actually plain wrong. But it was a very sophisticated, it was like a psyop, a sophisticated attempt to, by having a very complex explanation to confuse matters. The the description of what banks do that is correct is the credit creation explanation, which is much simpler and says that each bank creates the money completely out of nothing when it gives out a loan. And so it's not creating a fraction or anything, it's just creating 100% of the money is newly created by one bank that gives a loan. And 100% of the loan money is newly created. So there's no fraction here. In a way, you could say it's worse than the fractional reserve theory. In the fractional reserve theory, you get the idea that there's only a little bit of fractional money creation. And actually, by that perspective, the reality is worse because banks create all the money, and immediately when they give a loan, 100% of the loan is newly created and added to the money supply. That's the reality. So that's my first point. Try to drop the fractional concept because it's just not reality and it confuses and was actually designed to confuse. So we are playing into their hands if we use it, I would suggest. Now, the fungibility of money is important, but really with the fungibility, we mean the acceptance of a means of payment, whether it's generally acceptable, because then it's fungible. And it's acceptable. Well, that's like beauty in the eyes of the beholder, what is acceptable. So usually what's acceptable is what's credible and has established itself. And here, the most established in volume terms, clearly by far, is bank credit, which is fungible. Because banks have the institutional setup to do all these transactions for you, create money, inject it, do the transfers as you instruct the banks. You, as I said earlier, you can also have alternative systems. Presently, the bank credit is not privileged. Therefore, any company can say, we also issue credit. That's not illegal. You can issue a credit note, but the reality is people may not accept it. And then even if one person accepts it, they can't easily pass it on and use it therefore as general money because they don't have the institutional setup of the banks. And there is one hurdle that only if you have a banking license you can surmount, which is the privilege that you can accept what is called deposits. But we don't need to get into those details. So the reality is anyone can create credit. So in that sense, anyone can create money, but it's just not accepted by anyone. And so then when you have a community bank and a network of community banks and backed by the state bank, you have the money creation in the hands of the local people with backing of the state. That aims at supporting the state level economy and community. And that creates further credibility, acceptance, but also actual financial and economic stability in a time era where we have central planners that want to create and have a record of creating again and again instability and crisis and chaos in order to rearrange the chairs and do something that we don't actually want, but the central bankers want. And so, again, I mean, that's really what we should focus on. I think Catherine, again, probably has a much more succinct response that she just wrote there. Perhaps, Catherine, read it out, please, in your voice.
Yeah, so I was just saying one of the beauties of having community banks create money through the credit creation is they are responding to a fundamentally sound economic project,
Yes.
which warrants the liquidity, which warrants the money creation. And that's how you're getting so much growth without inflation. Now, presumably, it's enterprise activity as opposed to speculative activity. And that's why when the large banks do the real estate speculative activity or the crypto speculative activity, you get the inflation and the problems. But I do want to mention one of my favorite videos, which I've never been able to find, was a 3 or 4 minute short from it was in French, and it tells the story of a hotel owner. And a Parisian comes to the hotel. Have you seen this one, Richard?
There is an English version, a British
Oh, there
version.
is.
of a pub. It's in the pub, but go on.
Okay, so the hotel owner, as a man comes in from Paris, he says, "I'm exhausted. I want to go get lunch, but I want to rent a room." So he leaves his 200 francs with the hotel owner, and goes to eat lunch. And the hotel owner apparently owed the chef $200, so he runs to pay off his chef. The chef, it turns out, owes a farmer 200 francs, and he goes to pay it off. The farmer apparently owes the local prostitute 200 francs, so he pays the local prostitute, who owes the hotel owner 200 francs for the room she's been using at the hotel. She pays him back, and the Parisian comes back from lunch, goes up to check the room, comes downstairs and says, "I don't like the room. I'd like my money back." And the hotel owner gives him his 200 francs back. But they've extinguished essentially 800 francs of debt in the whole community just through the financial liquidity. So it's one of those arguments for community currencies. But
Yep,
I don't know if
very
you
good.
ever see that one, send it, because I want to keep publishing it again and again.
The British one had a slightly different, number of players, and perhaps slightly less colorful, I dare say.
Was French. Okay,
Yes.
so we have Earl, so we have a question from Earl, and I believe you run the Public Banking Institute in Denver, correct?
Well, we have a 501c3 nonprofit, and we're trying to generate either a state level bank in Colorado or authorize local public banks at the city, county, local level. And we've drafted legislation that we think is suitable. And the more we thought about it, the more we thought that the way North Dakota did it is a good model. And I'm glad to see that Richard's model, I was reading your model for Florida, pretty much follows that model. Some of the things that we've learned from experience are important to keep that North Dakota had is number one, not be a member of the FDIC. The FDIC was designed to prevent a run on the bank. Primarily, and if you have just one major depositor like the Bank of North Dakota or the Bank of Colorado, you're not going to have a run on the bank if it's required to keep its deposits in the bank. And of course, FDIC insurance has a $250,000 limit, so it really would be of little or negligible value, if any. And also, not requiring 100%, roughly 100% collateral for public deposits that are not insured. That, again, not being subject to a run on the bank is another reason for not requiring that. And another reason for not requiring that, there's several, is that you. Excuse me, I lost my train of thought. The there
Another
there's a
reason why
con
we
there's
don't
a
need
there's a
FDIC,
significant
right?
there's a significant conflict of interest between Chase or one of the other major banks holding public deposits and the government whose deposits it holds. And with that conflict of interest, the incentive for the private bank is by law to maximize its own profit. And that results in them often investing in things that don't serve the community. They invest outside the community, make loans outside the community. They may do things that are environmentally damaging. You don't have that conflict, and therefore you don't have that need, besides not having to run on the bank, you don't have that need to protect the bank from its own government or vice versa. A third one is to have the bank be the depository for its own government's deposits. That's the case in North Dakota, and I've noticed some of the legislation outside in other parts of the country have not really done that. They've limited the amount of deposits they put in the public bank, and it seems to me it makes more sense to put all of them in it. If you don't have the expertise, you can acquire it, so that those deposits are well handled and well invested. Two other things that I think are very valuable that North Dakota did is to not have the bank regulated by the state banking board, but really directly by its own legislation. And its own legislation, in our case, for example, would do what Richard recommends, which is to focus lending on productive lending for new goods and services that are not inflationary, that build GDP, build the economy, and not to inflate existing assets that create bubbles and, of course, lead to crashes. And then another common rule locally in state banking boards is to not let a new bank borrow money to get started. Well, that makes sense for a private bank because they need to get depositors, they need to get borrowers to get loans started. A public bank has huge advantages in those areas. One is they can immediately transfer deposits from their current public depository, such as one of the major banks. And they also generally have a backlog of loans. And the bank could initially refinance or directly finance the government's own projects. And have an immediate source of income, so they'll make a profit in the very first year, and successively. Those are, I think, some of the things that we think appear to be apparent in your model for Florida, and that I think would be invaluable for public banks around the country.
Very well put, very well put, and I entirely agree. The one of the insights not to register with the FDIC because, an agency that closes down healthy banks, I mean, why would you submit to that and then give them the ability to close you down just because you're doing your job and you're healthy as a bank? And you're right, it's not needed, therefore, no justification. In fact, as you also put quite well, you can have very simple your own regulations, and the key regulation you need is where's the money going to? If it's used for productive business investment, then it's really de-risking banking, and then you don't need complex risk management, which inevitably fails. I mean, all the Basel regulatory approaches have never prevented banking crises, and they will fail again. Basel III, Basel IV, because they encourage the risky lending through the risk weights, where land collateralization, property collateralization, is favored, and lending for productive business investment is discouraged. Well, you can just put in very simple, succinct, legislation that the majority, let's say, or something of the lending should be for a business investment, then you have de-risked it, and you can really disprove the whole Basel approach by essentially you just need that one rule, and you could scrap all other bank regulation, and they're so complicated. I mean, the EU, of course, holds the record in lengthy and complex bank regulation, with several huge pieces of legislation, 700 pages. That's completely crazy. You could scrap all that, just have a few very simple rules, and create a very sound banking system.
Richard, I wanted to bring up deglobalization. I've just been looking at the economies of several states, and they have big trading relationships with Canada, Mexico, and China. They're importing a lot, exporting a lot, and we are now watching both because of the changes in the cost of transportation and trade, as well as the increased tensions in the tariff wars and changes in federal policies, as well as now what appear to be significant federal layoffs coming. We're watching a dramatic change in what's economic to do locally versus globally. And you would think that's a moment in time when you need enormous liquidity to help your entrepreneurs get
Exactly.
from here to there. And so, if anything, this is a time when you need a
Absolutely.
wealth of local banks and a state bank.
Exactly. I mean, the timing is perfect, actually. It fits very much into the policies that are now coming on vogue. And therefore, it's clear what you need is more than ever before, state banks and creation of encouraging the creation of local community banks.
Right.
We need a whole new push to do that. And there is a chance that we can get the right people to back this, because I recently saw a quote from President Trump where somehow the discussion, I mean, I didn't see the earlier discussion that prompted him to say this, but he said, "I don't want to be a second Hoover." And that is the big risk, because Hoover was really a president who, again, I mean, in many ways, he was pushed to follow a script. He was the bad guy. He was made to be the bad guy who starts a trade war, puts up tariffs. He rose popular vote and then takes these bad economic policies, daring to intervene in international trade, essentially, working against the globalization. But that was, he was meant to do, and he was meant to fail badly so that they could then afterwards accelerate really hard in the opposite direction. And there is a risk that this is the scenario at the moment. But I was intrigued to see that Trump says, "I don't want to be a second Hoover." And so he may be aware that he was given that chance because they want him to be another Hoover. So we can give him the program to make sure he won't be another Hoover, but actually will lead people into this new world of prosperity and abundance, which is possible.
So we had a question from Carolyn. Ricardo, you want to read her Carolyn's question, and then I put up a link in response.
Sure. So, Richard, this is back to the technical side of the money creation narrative. So, here we go. Quote, "Since banks have to hold reserves, something like 10%, depending upon the credit of the instrument, doesn't that mean that they can newly create only the 90% portion of a new loan?" End quote.
Yes. So that is literally an example of the fractional reserve theory of banking. In reality, actually, the reserve requirements are lower. They're more like 1%, not 10%. That's
It's
just,
it was
by
in
the way.
2020 they moved it to zero, Richard. I put up
Well,
the link.
exactly. That it was going to be my next point to say is that in many countries, reserve requirements were abolished. Actually, even before 2008, in the UK and Sweden, and I think also Australia, already maybe 2, 3 decades ago, they abolished reserve requirements entirely. Which shows already, that in itself shows that this fractional reserve theory can't really be the one that explains what's going on, because you don't even have reserves anymore, required reserves anymore. But anyway, even if we have, and in the US, certainly the framework still exists. Also, in Europe, the framework exists. And I think formally there may be very low, close to zero, or let's say zero. What if we have a little bit of a reserve? Wouldn't this create still the same type of scenario, maybe numerically not so prominent? Well, the important thing to understand here is that when banks, sorry, when central banks impose reserve requirements, I mean, they're very concrete rules, and they're imposed and measured on a monthly basis. So you have a point in time during the month where you measure whether each bank meets the required reserve balance. Most central banks use the 15th of the month just because there are already all sorts of pressures for the month end. Various other deadlines, company corporate account closings, market closings, whatever recordings, earnings reports, whatever. And they didn't want to add another deadline to that deadline, which could lead to too much pressure and fluctuations. And so they choose mostly the mid of the month. And so when you observe the pattern of building reserves among banks towards the deadline, what has been empirically observed is that, you see, there may be a situation, in fact, often it may be the case, that there aren't enough reserves in the system because, as it happens, banks created too much credit. Of course, you don't, as an individual bank, most banks then assume, oh, we can borrow reserves from another bank because, other banks may have excess reserves. But each bank doesn't know the situation of the other banks. So they all sort of hope, okay, we just borrow reserves from the other banks. And then as you approach the deadline, the 15th of the month, or whichever it may be in which country, you then get a spike of the interest rates in the interbank market as they all scramble for reserve liquidity. They want to borrow from each other. Turns out there aren't enough reserves. And what happens? And this is again an empirical finding. Central banks, of course, are watching this, and because they've actually set targets for the short-term interest rate in the interbank market, and they notice, oh, they're spiking up, we have to deliver reserves. So they provide reserves, they inject the reserve. So that means, and this is it's well shown in many countries. So then central banks end up always delivering, injecting the reserves needed for banks to meet the reserve requirement. And as a result, reserve requirements have just been it's just another bureaucratic rule and mechanism, but it doesn't serve the function that the textbooks claim they serve, namely, it restricts credit creation in any way. It doesn't. And that's, of course, the very reason why so many countries have moved to dropping reserve requirements, because they serve no useful function. And so then scrap them entirely, like in the UK, or set them at zero.
It's always amazing to listen to you, Richard, because things are never as we were taught.
I always tell my students, it's you're as a rule of thumb, you're more likely to be right than wrong if you always do the opposite of what the textbook says.
So I would say the biggest challenge facing a state legislator who wants to do a sovereign state bank is they are being lobbied heavily by a variety of special interests who want to do something that makes the money. And there's no constituency who understands yet that a sovereign state bank, if you look at what can happen to the economy during deglobalization with a successful sovereign bank versus, not having it, I mean, everybody's going to make a lot more money, but there's no constituency who sees it as, something that's going to immediately, right.
Well, I mean, there's a theoretical constituency, and we have to figure out how to approach them and then mobilize them for us. Namely, the majority of employment is with small firms, and those small firms, their prosperity depends on the existence of thriving small local banks, which again will be the case if you have a state bank. So in this chain of causation, I think it's the many small firms. If we can organize them and go to and get the local chambers of commerce and small business associations to understand this and back it, they're the ones that will initially as the first receiver of those loans benefit. And if that's understood that this is the mechanism, then they should be backing this. And of course, they're the main employer, so there is a link to essentially the general voter.
So I have to say, I think Tim Caban is a genius at figuring out elevator speeches. So the next thing I'm going to do after this is talk to him about what I can hear his wheels spinning as we're talking. So
Very good. Excellent, Tim. We
any
look forward to that.
Tim, anything you want to add about the importance of elevator pitches?
I think the whole reason for the speech is everybody understands the importance of them to communicate, because people, especially in today's world where there's such a limited attention span for many people. So
Right.
we'll work on it for sure.
We'll work on it. Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for joining us. The link for the slides is in the chat. If you want a copy of the slides, and we will be making an edit of this and make it available to the public. Again, Tim and I will be back in March to look at model precious metals legislation for states. And again, make your reservations with Elizabeth. If there's anything we can do for you and your team, you'll let us know. But finally, Richard, I just can't thank you enough. I keep learning more each time I hear you talk. And
Thank you.
I think your work for the states who follow up and proceed to do this, your work will make an enormous difference. So.
Let's work on mobilizing support for this. So,
Yes,
thank you to you,
absolutely.
Catherine, for all your support and all the things you're doing, and everyone who's joined the call and spread the word. Let's go and do
Yeah.
it.
You have a wonderful evening.